And that's most people. Should be here. No, there's still a few more coming in. But anyway, for this morning session, that if I just gave a talk and followed the schedule, which was from 8:15 to 9:45, that's a long time, and people start getting very restless, especially that the last half an hour is supposed to be doing metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. And many times you just had your breakfast, you rushed in here, and about the 9:15 or 9 o'clock, if I was really kind to you, I'd let you do what you need to do, which is go to the letting go rooms. So we don't call these things toilets in Buddhist monasteries. We call them letting go rooms. So what we're going to do, well, it's 8:15 now, I'm going to try, if it's at all possible, to give a shorter talk until 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, we can have a toilet break and then come back by 9:15 to do the loving-kindness meditation till 9:45 or just before. And after you're all blissed out with loving-kindness and you've all been totally brainwashed, then we'll pass a donation box around. I should let you know my tricks. No, we don't do things like that. But this is one of those stories to get donations. There was a monk a long time ago. He started off a temple in Australia, not me, and another part of Australia. And it's very, very hard to get enough money to pay the bills. So he was really struggling. So he went to see this senior monk and said, how do you do this? And the senior monk said, very simple. When you give the weekly Dhamma talk, make sure you turn the heaters up. Close all the windows. Make it really stuffy. And when... Someone's taking a photograph of you there. And when... When people start to... and give a very boring sermon. In a monotone so people get to sleep and they don't really want to listen anyway. And people... And when they start to fall asleep, get out your watch. You know the old fob watch? Do it backwards and forwards. And when they're all hypnotized, then you can tell them, today, when you go out, no coins, no 5s, 10s, 20s, only 50s and 100s in the donation box. And he said, I can't do that. That's fraud. That's cheating. He said, no. It's encouraging people to make good karma. So he tried it anyway because he was desperate. It worked really well. Just people fell asleep, or just before they fell asleep, got the clock out and just hypnotized them all. And the donation box was full of $1,500 notes. He really cleaned up. But he was smart enough to realize you can't do that every week. People will soon suss him out and he'd be busted. So what he did was waited for a few weeks. When we're short of cash again, he sort of turned the heaters up, closed all the windows, gave a very boring talk. And then when they were just about to fall asleep, he took his watch out. He's thinking about it. And he dropped the watch. Yeah, and he said, oh, shit. And it took them a month to clean up the hall. Okay. Sorry, enough about that. But anyway... It's coming towards the end of the retreat. Or is it? Didn't we ever tell you the future is uncertain? You can't predict what's going to happen next. Don't you believe that? Or do you think it's just empty words? So, It reminded me of, I usually told a story every end of every retreat a long time ago, but I haven't told a story for a while now. Because there was this monk, and he was a Kiwi and a New Zealand man. And I got to know him when he came to visit Thailand, first of all, before he went to South Korea to ordain. He preferred that Zen tradition. But it's a much tougher tradition. So once he ordained, they were doing this retreat. Every year they do this 60-day retreat. Not just 9 days, not weekenders. 2 months. And it's really strict. So you have your place in the hall. There's obviously noble silence. I could never explain what noble silence is, did I, on this retreat? Did I? Noble silence means there's no bells. There's no bell silence. Because I went, oh, come on, give me a break. I've been on all these retreats, and you're just about to get enlightened, and then boom. Other times, and this was more accurate, other times you're really sleepy and tired, and you really want to go to the toilet, and you just want to go to bed, and you just don't want to be here. And there's Ajahn Chah sitting next to the bell, and he won't ring it. And you know what I thought sometimes? I had this like fantasy dream. Not really dream, but just a plan. To get one of the, you know, those slingshots that, you know, you a bit of elastic, put it back. And I was gonna train in the forest where no one can see me until I was accurate. And then when I wanted to leave the meditation or something, I get out my little slingshot and hit the bell and go boing, and then so Ajahn Chah wouldn't see me. I was too scared to do that, in case I missed and hit him. But, you know, sometimes that bell can cause you so much misery. So that's why we have no bell silence. And you know what happens? When you have no bell silence, no bells, you know, people actually meditate more. They stay up later, they get up earlier, because they're meditating because they enjoy it, not because they're afraid. And some people, on the noble silence retreats, some people get so peaceful that they win the Nobel Peace Prize. Okay. Let's get on to the story instead. So this monk, he went to this Zen tradition, ordained, and he's going to face a 60-day retreat. And you have your little zafu there in the place, in the hall. And you meditate there. It's usually 45 minutes sitting meditation all together. So you can't just do what you want to do. 45 minutes sitting meditation, 15 minutes walking, just around the hall. Don't go outside. Another 45 minutes sitting, another 15 minutes walking meditation throughout the day. And for lunch or breakfast, I think they have 3 meals a day there, but the meal is brought to you, right in front of you. You can't get up and walk away. You can't go just, you know, to have some relaxation or whatever. It's right there in front of you. And the end of the day, that's where you sleep as well. So you don't get out of the hall, except the only time you can get out of the hall, obviously to the toilets, but the only other time is to have your interview with the master. And those teachers in South Korea, they're not like Ajahn Brahm. Oh, no. They are tough. They are fierce. Did that work? I saw Nicholas just jump there. And if you don't get the questions right, they ask you questions. If you don't get the questions right, they whack you with the Zen stick. Whoa, it's really scary. So even though it means you can get out of the hall for 5 minutes, sometimes you'd wonder whether that's a good idea. So this monk had to do this 60-day retreat. And just even after the first day, you know what it's like, you know, meditating? You know, do lots of meditation. You know, your knees ache, your back aches. And that's what's happened to him. Even after just one day, his back was sore and his knees were hurting. But it came the time, go to sleep, 10 o'clock. So just where he was, he lay down, fell asleep very quickly, and before he knew it, get up, because it was 3 o'clock in the morning. That's when they got up. And sit down, meditate. Another day, 45 minutes sitting, 15 walking, 45 sitting, 15 walking, 45 sitting. And after even 2 days, he'd had enough. He said, when I was in New Zealand, I never had to meditate that hard. This is crazy. But he saw all his friends, not friends, but associates, all these other South Korean monks, they were sitting there so peacefully. And he thought, it'd be embarrassing for me to run away now. What will that do to Kiwi pride? So he sat there for another day, and another day. He said it was really hard, a lot of pain and suffering, but he managed to get through the first week. And by the first week, oh, his body was so sore, it was really aching, pain here, pain everywhere. But he'd done a week. Let's try another week. And the hours, they stretched so long. It was so painful, but now let's see if I can endure this. And every time he thought, just let's get out and run away, he looked at those other monks. And soon, he got to 1 month. He'd actually made 1 month of very, very tough training. And from that point, halfway, he said, well, I've got halfway now. So I'm sure I can do the other half. Anyone who thinks like that, they're halfway through. The second half is always 3 or 4 times as long as the first half. It's like time starts to stretch and elongate. And so the fifth week was even more pain and suffering. The sixth week, he didn't know how he could endure this, but it's only because to leave now would be unfaithful to all the endurance he'd done so far. So he kept on going. 7 weeks went past. 59 days, he woke up in agony for the last day of the retreat, but only 1 day left. The last day, like today for you. Only a few hours to go. So he sat down there. Oh, it was just so painful. But he kept on going. And soon, a 45-minute walk, 45-minute sit, quarter of an hour walk, 45-minute sit. And he got to the last meditation. Only another 45 minutes, and then the retreat will be over. And in those retreats, after the retreat was over, they had this wonderful hot bath. And he was just looking forward to that hot bath so much, soaking his tortured knees and back. And after the bath, there was always a feast there. And he was thinking of all the delicious food he could eat, not sitting in his meditation place. He could just take it out into the garden and stuff himself. And he was just fantasizing about that and the last meditation. And he thought, well, maybe at least half an hour's gone past. And he opened one eye. 5 minutes. That's all. Has that ever happened to you? When you really count the minutes, you open the eye and only 5 minutes, it can't be. So he closed his eyes again and waited another half an hour, opened his eyes, another 5 minutes. And then he started to, you know, like we do, to negative fantasies. He thought, well, what if the battery of the clock is running low? And the clock is going extra slow. It does happen, you know. What happens if the clock runs out of, or the battery runs out of power? And the clock gets stuck 10 minutes before the end of the retreat forever? Would any of these smart aleck monks know that? And all that last 45 minutes. It wasn't like an hour. It wasn't like a day. It was like a week. And especially as it got close to the last minute. Oh, that last minute was like an hour. But then, he heard it. The sweetest sound he'd ever heard in his life. The last gong. The retreat was over. He'd done it. He'd made it. Yes. It's a great sense of achievement. You know, when you, and through mostly endurance and through strength of character, that you push through and you make it through so much pain. He was about to bow and get up when the teacher made an announcement, said, oh, just stay put for a moment. I've just got an announcement for you. In all the interviews, all the private interviews like you do with me here, people have been getting so much benefit out of this retreat. It's one of the best retreats ever for you. And about four or five of you have actually asked, is it possible to extend the retreat? I've been considering that this morning, and I think it's a jolly good idea. Cross your legs, the retreat is extended for another week. And this poor Mark Cowell, he had to close his eyes. Another week. And he said, he told me afterwards what it was like. Sort of, he wasn't really watching his breath or doing anything. He was just trying to figure out who those three or four monks were. And what he was going to do to them once he found out. Really unmonkish, cruel things to them. They did this to him. They're going to get their own back. And he was thinking like this. And when he was consumed by sheer malice, anger and revenge, the bell went again. Half an hour had gone past, just like that. And then the head monk said, OK, retreat over. You got the hot baths and the feast for you. And Hanwal was just is worrying, what's going on? Is the retreat over or is it carrying on? What's happening? And one of the other monks, the older monks, came out to him and said, look, that senior monk does the same trick every year. And Hanwal, he told me personally, he learned much more in that last half an hour than for the whole 2 months retreat. How expectations, how putting all your eggs in one basket that the retreat is going to end this morning. Perhaps it won't. Who knows? Shall we have a vote on it? Who thinks the retreat should carry on for another week? Okay, majority. So all of you, unpack your bags. No, I won't do that for you. But anyway, that was a wonderful ending of a retreat that sometimes we send our mind off into the future, far too far, which means we cannot adjust to, you know, things changing. I still remember just visiting Thailand after many years as a monk over here, and visiting there, and oh, people just really happy to see me. And so eventually, after my short visit, they arranged a little, almost like a tea party. You can't have much celebrations as a monk. We had some tea and some cheese and other stuff. And they sort of wished me off. They'd come back again soon. So they had a car, sent me to the airport. But you know what happened? That Thai Airways never told me that they changed the time of the air flight. So by the time I got to the airport, the flight had already taken off. Not my fault, it was just the Airways had never told me about the change. So then they rescheduled me for the flight the next day. But then I had nowhere to go. So I got in the car and went back to the monastery again. I said, hi again, I'm back. It was really embarrassing. But I said, okay, fair enough. We're not going to give you a party again tomorrow, though. One departure party is enough. But these sorts of things teach you, you don't know what's going to happen next. So we learn, you know, from an experience like a retreat, to learn to live more in the present moment. In other words, and see what happens, you know, lunchtime, afternoon, whatever, and just be adaptable, be able to change whatever happens in your life. And when you can do things like that, that you're far less worried about the future. You find out you can manage somehow or other, it works out. So anyway, that was a story which I usually say at the end of a retreat, but I think I'll get into big trouble from the retreat manager, who's probably looking forward, yay, no more managing, I can just relax now. Is that true? By your silence, I know that's true. But anyhow, that you're soon to go back to where you came from. You know, that's sometimes, what does that mean? Because I remember just, I went to, because we all get on together here in sort of the different religions, different parts of Buddhism. There was this one Zen monk. He was going to be promoted to be a Roshi, a teacher. And that's all. I don't know if anyone knows Ross Bolitar. He's a bit of a musician, but he was going to be promoted to be a teacher. And so he invited me to his ceremony. And I should be really careful not to be invited to ceremonies, because when I go to a ceremony, I have to give a speech as well. And I hadn't prepared anything, but just that morning on the way there, I was walking through the, I think, purse somewhere. You know that people shout all these, and they try to upset you. And then they shouted out at me. Now, they thought I was an Asian. You know, I didn't realize I was from London. Because I was wearing robes, they thought I was, you know, from sort of Southeast Asia. And they said, go back to where you came from. You know, these are the racists. And so I remembered that and said to the, in my talk to the Zen monks, I said, I was amazed after all these years how much Buddhism has become understood in Perth. Even I said this morning, this young man shouted out at me, hey you, go back to where you came from. I said, that's what we're all trying to do. And a little bit of Zen humor, they like that. But anyway, so when you, is that where you come from? Now people would ask Ajahn Chah that, where do you come from? You know what he would always say? He didn't ever say he was from Thailand or he was from Northeast Thailand or this village. When the people ask, where are you from? He'd always say, from my mother's tummy. You can't argue with that, can you? So, where are you from? Where are you from? From my mother's tummy. Anyway, that was one of the nice things which I liked about that, you know, this type of Buddhism. You could actually innovate, see things differently, and you get much more interesting understanding that way. So anyway, all the things which you hear here is only a fraction of what is really truth and Dhamma, but you're opening your mind up, little tricks, little techniques, allowing your mind to become peaceful and still. And when it's peaceful and still, as I always say to you, you can see much more. Yeah. Enhancing your perceptions and your senses. So you see much deeper, you hear much more of what's going on. And you can appreciate it better. You can feel this body. I'm supposed to be old and have lots of aches and pains. You know, most of the time when I feel the body, I can relax all the aches and pains and feel it nice tingling with happiness, with relaxation. It's just, you know, what I've trained myself to do over these years. As I said, I think one of the talks, perception of the beauty of relaxation, the beauty of peace. The beauty of silence. The beauty of poo. No, POHH. In the toilet bowl. I don't put bears in toilet bowls. Actually, no one has ever asked me that. What have you got all these bears here for? You know what you've got bears here for? Because there's mindfulness. It's called bear awareness. I think I'm going to retreat now. They always used to say bear awareness, B-A-R-E, awareness. That's what you're supposed to do. But I think bear awareness is much better, B-E-A-R, awareness. Because bear awareness is, you add the kindness there, the joy, the beauty, the happiness. If you just got awareness, which is just bare, nothing else but awareness, it can be very cold, negative, hard. It doesn't get you anywhere. But bear awareness, it means actually you engage with this moment. You're caring for it. It's very easy to care for a bear. You know, you can have a partner in life, you can have kids, you can have even like a dog, but a bear. A bear never sort of licks you to death. Never asks for anything. The bear never poos its pants like kids do. The bear never sort of leaves you and causes you trouble like a partner might. Very good family member. Bear awareness. It never asks for anything. It always gives you what you can see in it. But anyway, you learn so much on these retreats, surprisingly. You say surprisingly because learning is not knowledge. It's not sort of going back and you've learned the seven enlightenment factors, the five hindrances, the four noble truths, all the stages of meditation, blah, blah, blah. You don't learn the theory. You learn something much more powerful. What's behind all that theory? And the kindness. And the way that it was, Leha just sent me an email. I saw it this morning. Please put some quote on the board. Oh my goodness, what should I put on? But that's a little good quote which comes up. You know, hopefully you've seen it. I want happiness. Do you want happiness? How do you get happiness? This is a simple, amazing, really essential part of a meditation retreat. I want happiness. Why is it so hard to get happiness? And of course, on that board there, you can find the answer. It's so easy. I want happiness. So you let go of the I. No self, no me, no sort of ego. You let go of the wanting. No want. What's left? Happiness. I want happiness. You let go of the I, let go of want, and you got happiness. That is very profound. But sometimes people think, well, that's just so superficial. The superficial, simple things are not superficial at all. They go very, very deep. And this is what we learn here. And what you learn here is important throughout your life, wherever you're going. When you go to work, when you retire, when you can't sleep at night, you learn how to overcome insomnia. It's very easy to overcome insomnia. You just listen to one of my talks. And people do that. It was even the last time I was in the United States, in Berkeley, in October, November last year. And I was in Berkeley, and they were introducing me. You know, you have the MC. This is Ajahn Brahm, you know, from Perth, Australia. And this lady who made the introduction said, I go to bed with Ajahn Brahm every night. So I think, no, you don't. I'm going to sue you. But then she explained, and I knew what she was up to. She said that she listens to my talk every night on one of the talks, and it sends her, gets her into a nice mood, and she falls asleep very easily. And honestly, that many people do that. I think, what is going on there? And it is not just the Dhamma which they're learning, and they're not getting limiters. What they're getting is some reassurance, some nice soft words, kind speech. Just where these talks come from, you know, behind the talks, if you like, that reassures them and allows them to relax so they can have a nice good night's sleep. Even that much is a wonderful thing, to be able to sleep well at night. All of you, you know, haven't been able to sleep, and you got very, very tense physically and sometimes even sick. And it's a problem in the modern world. People don't even know how to sleep. So our modern world is like that. It just comes to my mind, that person who woke up after an operation in hospital and he complained to the nurse that his head was really painful. This nurse, oh, you're just imagining it. You know, we didn't even touch your head. It was like a keyhole surgery in your stomach. He said, but my head hurts. Oh, said the nurse, you felt the head. And actually, there was a swelling there. It was red. So he said, this is really weird. So she called the surgeon and said, that patient is complaining about sort of a big headache and he's got a very sore head. And the surgeon, oh, yeah, that's to be expected. I didn't think you operated on it. He said, no, we operated on his tummy. But halfway through the operation, we ran out of anaesthetic because we're cutting costs. So we used the traditional method. Come here. But anyway, we learn how to innovate. We run out of anesthetic. it's what you learn here in just seeing things in a different way. And sometimes some of the wise teachings, which are so easy to understand, but they can apply them so deeply. Open the door of your heart. Just don't feed the monster who's come into your palace. Be loving and kind to all beings, and they look after you. There's so much in each retreat, little things which sometimes people don't notice. How much you've been brainwashed. And sometimes when I was meditating my life, sometimes I stopped a few times and said, where did that come from? Where did I learn that? Because I didn't learn it from any books. Or the psychology, which I know. I never studied psychology at university, never read any books. But still, you understand quite deeply how your mind works and share that with others. And it's the experience you get from this retreat. And sometimes the way it's explained to you, the words, you don't need to even write them down. They've got inside you. They may be translated in your own words, your own way of doing things. They come out when they're needed. Many of the things which, the problems I had in meditation, the solutions, I came up with these ideas and I thought, wow, that's really wise. Where did that come from? And it came from Ajahn Chah. Little things he told me, which I'd forgotten. At least I thought I'd forgotten. Ajahn Chah was my teacher, a very inspiring man. But when he said things, I thought, no, that doesn't make any sense, and I rejected them. But no, they were so wise, they were in my brain somewhere. Like those seeds they have in the deserts. They just lay there dormant for enough years so that when the rain falls, when it's ready to be fertilized, they're there ready and flowers come up in the desert. They were my mind, the desert of my mind. Didn't realize how many seeds were planted there. And when the right conditions were there, they all blossomed. And that's, you know, why I teach you in these ways. Sometimes I teach really high, like jhanas and deep meditation, like frogs jumping out of the lake and standing on the dry land. And most of you will forget that. So you think. But then one day, you'll be not sure what you're doing. Could be a home, could be a meditation center, could be anywhere. And then you find yourself jumping out of the lake. Ooh, I've heard about that somewhere. This is where you heard it from. It's not me. Don't blame or praise me. Because I learned these things from Ajahn Chah and him from his teacher and his teacher and his teacher and his teacher and his teacher. So it all gets conditioned. So little by little, you find coming on retreats at all levels is really important. And even if all you ever did was sleep and eat, well done. How many places in the world can you come for 9 days and just have a nice place to rest and be able to eat delicious food and be looked after, be entertained in the evening by jokes? Bad jokes. And no one says anything. They don't criticize you. In fact, they even praise you. Isn't it a wonderful thing that you feel at all stages of the path you're accepted, you're welcome, that you belong? It's a wonderful thing to be accepted. And sometimes on these retreats, some people say, well, can't we have a special retreat for basic meditators? Can't we have another retreat for advanced meditators? Now, the trouble is, if we make it just for advanced meditators, everybody wants to come. They all think they're advanced. To prove that to you, can you be honest now? Really be honest. Put your hand up if you think you're above average intelligence. Okay, I think I made the point already. When you do this and people actually just are honest, usually about 80-90% of people think they're above average intelligence. That's impossible. Average means 50% maybe 49% are above average, 49% are below average. That's what average means. When you look at yourself, are you above average intelligence? Oh, yeah, yeah, well, yeah, I didn't get any degrees, but I'm above average. You can see just how people just bend the truth to fit their egos. So anyway, that it doesn't matter. And sometimes the measure of intelligence is not by being able to pass degrees and get certificates. Does that really make you intelligent? I don't think so. Sometimes it just makes you blind by your knowledge. Which is why one of those other little sayings which I've given you, never allow your knowledge, your learning, to stand in the way of truth. What does that mean? I mean, sometimes you meditate and you get some incredible deep insights. But that's not what it says in the books. That's not what mother and father told me. If it's your insight, follow it. It's truth. So anyway, little by little, we grow on this retreat. And again, people always want to ask this. And I saw it on the board, one of the other questions, that when people ask me, well, you know, this afternoon, I've got to go back to the real world. And when people ask me that, I say, what should we do when you go back to the real world? Because Jhana Grove here is not the real world, is it? Is it? This is the real world. Out there, when you go home, that's fake. It is fake. Because people just, they dye their hair. They just, they do nose jobs. They just have all this other sort of stuff to make them look nice when they're just old. There's no honesty out there in the world, is there? And you go to the shopping centres, and just it's all colours and music to try and get you to buy more and buy more and buy more. And they always say, oh, you know, you just no wisdom if you don't buy this expensive thing. Mm-hmm. And that's, to me, that's very, very fake. And you go to your houses, what's in your houses? TVs, it's all fake stuff. What is real? Even just your clothes you wear. And take off your socks and feel the reality of, you know, the wooden floor or the grass or the stones. Feel. Even when it rains. When was the last time you got soaked in the rain? Your body's quite okay getting soaked in the rain. You do it every day under the shower. Why not do it in a real rainstorm? And when you get into a puddle, just jump in it and go splash and get all dirty again, just like when you were a kid. Why not? Sometimes the reality of nature is something which we deny. We're told it's going to be unhealthy for you, it's bad for you. Don't do that. You look all muddy. You know, your hair, which you spent so much money just faking. You know, when I do marriage blessings, you know, why do I do marriage blessings for? I'm a monk. But the one part of it I really enjoy, and I must admit this, is sprinkling the bride with holy water. No, Heidi's in the back there. When she married Dennis really, and he was so scared. No, you got a good husband there, Heidi, because he was really caring for you. He said, please, Ajahn Pavlok, I've known you for many years. You're a good friend. Please don't speak it with holy water. But I have to. No, please don't. And she's wearing an expensive dress, which cost Dennis a lot of money. He said, please don't. No! So you're the only one, Heidi, which I sprinkle with virtual holy water. It was dry. But everyone else, they really get the full works. Which is why, you know, that you've seen me do this, Venerable. Sometimes I ask them, well, how much blessing do you want? We could always give three sizes, small, medium, or large. And when they get the large, I start sprinkling. And the poor bride, oh my goodness, all their expensive hairstyles starts to fall apart. All the makeup on her face starts to drip off. And I said, you wanted a real wedding. Now you can actually see what your woman you're going to commit to, what she really looks like. Oh, sometimes it does. But anyway, we learn a lot about reality. And your mind. Well, how's your mind? All right, sometimes it's really lazy. Sometimes it's angry. Sometimes your mind is really good. But all the time? When it's not so good, is that reality? Or are you trying to fix it up? You find you're always trying to fix up your mind. It's like being the caretaker of Jhanagraha, always trying to fix it up. You never sleep, Anusha, if you're trying to fix everything up. Make sure it's good enough. And what goes wrong, just, you know, hide it so I don't see it. So the things going wrong, things falling apart, things falling off, isn't that reality? Your mind having stupid thoughts, isn't that reality? Are you trying to live in a fake world mind? Or are you finally learning to actually make peace with your mind? With all its stupidities and all its eccentricities and all the things you spent years trying to get rid of and found it's impossible to get rid of those things. Make peace with it. And that's the powerful stuff happens then. When you make peace with your mind makes peace with you. It doesn't need all those stupidities. Just like the kid. When you're kind to your child, then the child doesn't throw a tantrum. So anyway, what are you going to do when you... Oh, no. Only 2 minutes. I've got too many stories to say. Okay, well, I'm going to behave. Maybe. But when you go home and you meditate, it's hard to meditate at home because there's so many other disturbances. So this little story, I wasn't going to tell this, I could tell a longer story, but never mind. This little story is one of these women. She lives in Armidale, used to come to our Armidale group, and a wonderful woman. She had two little children, 4 or 5 or something, and the children would never let her meditate when she was at home. She'd sit down, and then one of the kids would say, "Mummy, Mummy, I need a glass of water. Mummy, Mummy, I need to go to the toilet. Mummy, 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 Mummy." And though she was such a loving mother, of course she would get up to help her kids. But then she started to notice this happened more often when she sat on her cushion, closed her eyes, and started meditating. She soon realized that the kids just wanted attention. They didn't want to lose their mummy for half an hour in meditation. So one day she told me she was really determined. She sat on her cushion, crossed her legs, closed her eyes, and she determined, this is it, half an hour, and I'm not going to open my eyes for anything. So the kids, as soon as she closed her eyes, "Mummy, Mummy, I really need to go to potty. Mummy, 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 I really need something to drink." She just sat there. So then they upped their disturbance abilities by just crawling all over and pulling her hair. "Mummy, Mummy, Mummy." But even though it hurt and was disturbing, she didn't move. She just carried on meditating. And then they got to the ultimate level of trying to disturb Mummy. "Mummy, Mummy, Johnny has turned on the gas." "Mummy, Mummy, Paul has got the knife out of the kitchen drawer." Never underestimate the wisdom of your children. But Mummy, she's had enough of her kids disturbing her. And she said, you know, she made this resolution, and she was going to keep it. And she said, even if the kids blow up the house, if they cut each other into ribbons and there's blood all over the floor, I'm just going to carry on meditating. And she did. And after half an hour, not that long, when she opened her eyes, she saw her two children playing quietly in the corner. And the house hadn't been blown up. There's no blood on the floor. The knives were still in the drawer. And from that time on, she had won her ability to meditate. Every time she wanted to meditate, she sat down, and the kids, my mummy's meditating. And they were actually quite caring for mummy. They didn't make too much noise. They played in a corner rather than right in front of her. And so that's actually how we do these things. Win your ability to meditate. You do it and do it properly. And also the other thing is your kids, your husband, your wife, even your parents, they realize how good this is for you. And you find out that they want you to have a good meditation because you're a much nicer mummy after you've meditated. You're a much nicer spiritual dictator after you've been on a retreat. Whatever your job is, to rest is a blessing for everybody. So don't ever think you're just doing this for yourself. You're doing it for all the people in the world who have to put up with you. All the people who have to live with you, meet with you. If you're peaceful and kind and happy, then that's the gift you're going to give to others, whether you think about it or not. You don't have to be a teacher and tell them the Dhamma. Just give them a smile and be kind. And just your presence of softness and kindness and acceptance. That you will share with so many beings in this world. And not just human beings. With animals, with the cockatoos, with the snakes, the birds, everyone. And then you find you can be a very wonderful being. Okay, that's 3 minutes past nine already. I've gone 3 minutes over time. It's not that bad. So now let's have a letting go break. There's only a few toilets, so the ones who get there first are the ones who will be able to relieve their suffering first. So on your marks, get set, go! So please try and be back by 9:15 or roughly, and we'll do a guided meditation on loving kindness then.